The Guardian.
Hello everyone, this is Guardian Football Weekly Extra, the Premier League. Games keep on coming, Manchester City keep on winning. Harry Kane breaks some records, is the calendar year a thing? Liverpool have got Van Dijk, will that fix their defence? Elsewhere, Callum Wilson's touch of magic, President George Weah, your questions, feedback corner, and that's Football Weekly Extra. Simon Burton, hello.
Hi.
Nice to see you.
Pleasure to be here.
Did you have a nice Christmas?
I had a very nice Christmas. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Sachin Akrani. Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Did you have a nice Christmas?
Relaxing Christmas, enjoyable Christmas,
okay,
yeah.
Marvelous.
Good.
Jonathan Wilson, hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm okay, thanks.
Did you have a nice Christmas?
I'll tell you, the high point was Sunderland 1, Birmingham 1. Draw your own conclusions.
Billy says, have you all been drinking again? Should do it more regularly, much more fun. Who can drink the most pints? Did anyone have a pint of wine? Jonathan, I was hoping this would be a sober pod after... And there's Jonathan Wilson. I do wonder if this is going to be every single time now and how people would feel about this. The rules of pods over Christmas. One take, no edits. Drink what you like. So while you pour that, Jonathan, let's hear it. It's nice. Is it an expensive drop?
It was 50 quid for two bottles.
Hmm.
It's a Jean-Paul Deville. Mm-hmm. I'd never heard of it before, but it was on sale in St Pancras as I came south.
Okay, marvellous.
Can you claim that on expenses, given it's a Guardian pod that you're pouring it for?
I shall speak to my accountant and find out.
Right, let's start with Virgil van Dijk then. £75 million once all the add-ons are concluded, gone to Liverpool. Rumours that City were interested as well. And I don't know, Sachin, if City were interested and I was Virgil van Dijk, I'd have just gone to City and just picked up a Premier League winner's medal just by arriving.
Yeah, it does seem, to use that cliche, his heart was set on the move to Liverpool. He obviously wanted to go in the summer. Liverpool botched that up completely for reasons I've probably been talked about on this pod and other podcasts many times. Yeah, I think, I mean, reading sort of articles today and, you know, getting insight from the guys who know Liverpool closer than I do, the sense was that he was absolutely dead on working under Jurgen Klopp specifically, on being the leader in Liverpool's defence, which he wouldn't necessarily be at City's. And he just really wanted to play at Anfield and, you know, all the history. I mean, I think it's fascinating. Liverpool haven't won the league since 1990, but that history thing still exists. There are still players who probably weren't even born when Liverpool won the league who want to play for the club because of their history. And that seems to have attracted him. But obviously the massive wages will probably help as well, I would have thought.
There was a story in the Liverpool Echo that Liverpool were so terrified of City coming in with a last-minute trumping bid that they sent their medical team, they flew their medical team to Bournemouth Airport and had them, you know, waiting, camped outside Southampton's training ground while the deal was being struck, so that there would be, like, to minimise as much as possible the intervening period between agreement and signature. So they obviously were worried. For all the talk that Van Dijk had his heart set on Liverpool, Liverpool appear not to have been absolutely convinced that was the case.
How good is Virgil van Dijk? And before you answer that, Jonathan, you know when you pour a bottle of wine, you don't necessarily have to pour all of it out at the same time. Or you just, was that for pod reasons?
It just seemed easier.
Okay, that's absolutely,
I mean, I've
fine.
Basically been out of action since you started talking while pouring that. I have now adequately poured it in roughly equal measures to five glasses. Hmm. And it all fitted because we're drinking out of beakers.
We've also got cups of coffee here, we should explain. So these are some incredible chasers that are about to be taken on this podcast.
How good is Virgil van Dijk, please, Jonathan?
He's good. I thought it was interesting last night, Pep Guardiola said that he was not interested in him at any stage, refused to entertain that notion at all, which I'm sceptical of, but that was what he said. But Klopp on Friday night was very clear, oh, it's individual errors, it's always individual errors, but I mean, it is, but it's individualised by different people all the time. Yeah, if it's not Minelay, it's Lovren. If it's not Lovren, it's Moreno. There's always people in that defence making mistakes, which suggests to me that it's the environment. Yeah, Lovren was a really good player when he left Southampton. We all thought he was very, very good. And he now has sort of become this strange sort of semi-joke figure. So I don't think there's any guarantee the same thing won't happen to Van Dijk, and that's not necessarily to say he's not a good player. But, you know... maybe he does have an aura and a confidence and authority which will spread and will will iron out those errors.
I have a different take on that, the individual errors thing. I was in the same press conference as Jonathan on Friday and put that to Klopp as well about the individual errors thing, because he says it multiple times after Liverpool concede silly goals. My issue is, I don't think Liverpool actually aren't as bad defensively as people think. They've only conceded 3 goals at Anfield in a legal season. They tend to dominate territory and possession, so they don't actually come under a lot of pressure from opposition teams. The problem is, when there's a big chance created against them, they tend to concede. And for me, that comes down to individual quality. If you take the Mignolet mess up on Friday, that's got nothing to do with, for me, the environment or the team or the tactics. That's because Mignolet is not a very good goalkeeper. And for me, the 3 key areas Liverpool need to improve are defensive midfield, centre-back and goalkeeper. Now, I'm not saying they've sorted the centre-back, but they've gone out and addressed that by signing Van Dijk, who, in my opinion, is excellent. I think he's a very, very good centre-back. But that doesn't mean their problems are over. They still need to get a defensive midfielder. I don't think Jordan Henderson's the answer. And they definitely need a goalkeeper. So you can spend as much as you want on centre-backs, but until those two positions are addressed as well, I don't think Liverpool's problems are going to be cured.
I fundamentally disagree with that. But Mignolet did make mistakes like that at Sunderland, because at Sunderland he was confident. It's a different type of game he was playing, obviously.
Yeah.
And Lovren didn't make the mistakes he's making now when he was at Southampton.
Is that a pressure thing? Paul Merson, who I obviously allude to a lot because he's the only footballer that I ever see, he always says, you know, at Arsenal, the pressure, if you lost a game, was huge. And if at Middlesbrough you did, well, it kind of didn't really matter.
And partly it's probably that, yeah.
And so when Van Dijk moves, I mean, it's a different test for you, because the scrutiny is higher, the pressure is higher, and every single point in every game.
But also the style of football is very different. I mean, Sachin's point about they're only letting in 3 goals at home this season. Well, the reason for that is that Liverpool sort of overwhelm you with the tempo, with the intensity. But if you can get beyond that, they're incredibly self-centred. So I guess the difficulty any team playing that style of football, you can almost say it's true of City to an extent, is can you play with that intensity? Can you play that high up a pitch? Can you smother teams in the way they try to and still retain some level of defensive solidity? And maybe you can't. Maybe that's the payoff.
Yeah. If you've got a better, for instance, defensive midfielder, would that not help?
Oh, sure. I think it would. I mean, obviously, better players will be more able to do it. And I think Van Dijk is better than any defender they've got at the club at the minute. I agree with that. But I'm not convinced that he will solve every problem.
Oh, on his own, definitely not. Absolutely not.
Well, they beat Swansea 5-0 anyway. Nice goal for Trent Alexander-Arnold. And a lovely finish from the Ox, Simon. I enjoyed those ones.
And Coutinho's goal, that was gorgeous. Mm. That was a great hit. It was a very depressing performance from Swansea. It was a real low display. And they were almost inevitably going to lose away at Anfield, given their form, confidence and general quality. But they still contrived to do so really very dispiritingly.
I was a huge fan of the dishevelled state of Oliver McBurnie, their centre forward, who played with Steve Claridge like socks around his ankles and actually didn't have a bad game, and sort of hiding to nothing playing up front on your own in a team that never have the ball. They've announced that Carlos Carvajal is their new manager, who recently left Sheffield Wednesday. Is this a good thing, Sachin?
It's a bizarre thing. I don't have an opinion on it. I'm sorry, Max, I know it's a horrible thing for me to say on a podcast where you're looking for opinions, but it's just a really strange one, because first of all, it's good in the sense that it's not one of the usual names, partly because all the usual names have now got back into work, including Tony Pulis at Middlesbrough. But equally, it's really weird. I can't think of the last manager who got sacked by a championship club who then walked straight into a Premier League job. Oh, Simon's got one.
Brian Laws.
Brian Laws is the one I was going to say, who was also sacked by Sheffield Wednesday. Though where the Carvajal was, it was one of those occasions that was announced as a mutual agreement, and now several days later looks like it probably was mutually agreed. The interesting thing about it, though, that Carvajal was first linked with Swansea 2 years ago when he was only 6 months into his stint at Sheffield Wednesday. And at that time he said, you know, I don't know about now, but, you know, maybe in a year or 2 years, this is something we could come back to. And here he is 2 years later, he's come back to it.
Oh, so they've remembered. That's nice.
So
on Brian Laws, there is one of my favourite things on YouTube is Brian Laws jumping over a canal. And on Soccer M, I started a feature called Managers Jumping Over Things in the desperate hope that other managers might see it and therefore jump over some things. But it was quite short-lived. But yeah, if you YouTube...
Did you find any others?
No. But if you YouTube Managers Jumping Over Things... No, I think you probably have to YouTube Brian Laws jumping over a canal. It's quite an anticlimax. It's just Brian Laws doing it.
How big is the canal?
It's quite small. Right. Yeah, it's really. It's,
I mean,
not,
is it a canal or is it a drainage ditch? Is it a culvert?
Come on, hang on a second.
While you're checking that, can I just recommend to people to check out Carlos Carvajal's Wikipedia page? His list of jobs is quite extraordinary. I think there's about 17.
Shall we go through them?
Yeah, there's about 17, and he spends no more than about a year at each club. It's
Espinho, Freamunde, Vizela, Arves, Lechoix, Vitória Setúbal, Belenenses, Braga, Beira-Mar, Vitória Setúbal, Asturias Tripoli, Maritimo, Sporting, Besiktas, Istanbul BB, Sheffield Wednesday, Swansea City. So the longest stay there is Sheffield Wednesday, by the looks of things.
2.5 seasons. I think he'll be fun. He's a kind of very bullish, I don't know. He's a kind of confident guy. He expresses himself in interesting ways in English. And I think he'll be good value. And he was also, and he's left, you know, managers always leave clubs under a cloud, and Sheffield Wednesday's results this season have been bad, and there's talk of him falling out with players and being his terrible training regimes being blamed for their injury problems. But Sheffield Wednesday have had a couple of very good seasons. His first two seasons at Wednesday both ended in the playoffs, once in the playoff final. He's had good results. And he's an interesting guy, and I'm kind of looking forward to the next 6 months.
Sorry to let you down. I can no longer find Brian Law, so you'll have to take my word for it. It's not a lie. If it was, it would be a very strange one. Spurs 5, Southampton 2, which was a lot of fun, and Harry Kane got all the headlines for his incredible calendar year, 39 goals in 2017 in the Premier League, beating Alan Shearer's record, 56 in all competitions, including for England, making him ahead of Messi, Ronaldo, Cavani and Lewandowski. I mean, the calendar year stat is, I don't know, bizarre. I mean, the only footballing-related thing is the Ballon d'Or, I think it's done calendar year-wise. But it doesn't mean Harry Kane's no good. I just don't understand why anyone obsesses with it, apart from to fill airtime over Christmas.
Did you know who held the record before? Until like a week ago when people started talking about it? Did you know that Shearer held that record?
No.
Yeah, me neither. I mean, this seems to be like a Gary Lineker Twitter-fueled thing where he was just trying to goad Shearer on Match of the Day by the fact that Kane was going to beat his record. I agree, it's a really arbitrary thing, and it doesn't really tell you anything because a calendar year is a weird thing to judge anyway, because the second half of the season is very different to the first. I mean, for me, the biggest thing about Kane is just his extraordinary consistency. I mean, I've got it here. He got 31 goals in the 14-15 season, 26 in the 15-16, 35 in the 16-17, and he's on 24 at the moment. So barring sort of injury or collapse in form, he's on course to score his most goals in a single season. I mean, he's an extraordinary goal scorer. He's also not a flat track bully. He scored against City, United, Chelsea, Liverpool, Arsenal, and also against Monaco and Dortmund in the Champions League. He's only 24, which I think is pretty remarkable as well. I mean, he's just a fantastic forward, and I think you should focus more on that than this, as I said, slightly odd calendar year thing.
I mean, Martin Tyler was saying on the commentary, kind of, and that's the goal that all these fans came here to see. Really? Like, how many of those fans knew, and B, how many of the ones who knew actually cared? Like, would they have gone home, you know, after Tottenham had won 3-0 and it was a Dele Alli hat-trick, going, well, I suppose 3 points, but, you know, it was a bit of an anticlimax.
In the football cliche world, it's when you sit your grandson on your knee, you can say, I was there when Harry Kane got the calendar year record. No, I mean, I think it's ridiculous as too. I think the fascinating thing...
more significant is the fact that in a over a 12-month period that hasn't been picked especially to prove this point, but is a, you know, a 12-month period that's kind of, you know, we accept that years are things, right? You know, a year is not a totally ludicrous measure. It's not totally arbitrary. And the fact he has beaten Messi and Ronaldo in that period, I think, is extraordinary.
The actual extraordinary thing is when they show you the list of top goalscorers in Europe for each of the years, it's always around 60, except, was it 2011, 2012, when Messi scored 91? That's sort of like Don Bradman, isn't it, compared to everyone else? It's utterly ridiculous. Southampton are really not very good, Simon.
They certainly weren't very good in that game. And the whole Van Dijk thing, he's been really poor this half season. And Liverpool spent £75 million on a kind of not that distant memory of a player rather than an actual player. And so, yeah, Southampton, And they struggle. They've got Shane Long in attack, a guy who's he just doesn't score goals. He's a non-goal scoring striker now. And I mean, they ran around a bit. They did a bit of charging about, but yeah, they were not in that game.
And Southampton fans, who were probably not too unhappy for Claude Puel to leave in the summer, even though he got them, what, eighth into the League Cup final, would have him back in a heartbeat now, Sachin.
Yeah, I mean, they've only scored 20 goals this season. I was just looking here, which is one of the lowest totals in the Premier League. And they sacked Claude Puel because the football's too boring. I mean, I know a Southampton fan quite well, and he was saying, he's not saying this in hindsight, he was saying this at the time, that he didn't want Puel to go, and he felt this was a decision that was taken because of pressure from a small minority of vocal Southampton fans. It's almost like the first kind of social media sacking almost. It was sort of the vocal minority getting a manager sacked. I mean, I thought at the time it was ridiculous to get rid of Puel. Eighth in the league, as you said, League Cup final. And it seems to have gone backwards. I mean, Jonathan might know more about Pellegrino than me, but I think he was quite defensive at... Where did he come from? Malaga, was it? Wasn't he quite a defensive manager? So I don't know why they thought he would suddenly get them playing beautiful attacking football. But
you might have just found Jonathan Wilson's Achilles heel in football knowledge.
One bit of football. I was trying to work out how many goals Harry Kane had scored since Shane Long last scored.
It's about 40-odd, yeah.
Is it 40-something, yeah.
40-something, yeah. So, yeah, it was a strange decision. And
it's 50, it's exactly 50, sorry. 50, yeah. I found it, exactly 50. So, I wasn't. What was the question? I was paying no attention. So,
was it Malaga he came from, or Alaves? I can't remember which one. I think it was Malaga. Or was it Alaves? It was Alaves, wasn't
50
it?
50 goals in Shane Long.
this is gonna hit our one take, no edit.
Anyway, wherever he came from, yeah, he wasn't a particularly attacking manager. So to get him in to try and make the team more attacking was always a strange decision, and they're paying the price for that now, I think.
Southampton go to Old Trafford on Saturday. Spurs go to Swansea on the 2nd of January. We'll get on to Manchester United in just a second.
He was at Alaves.
He was at Alaves. Yeah, so you were right. Second time. Which is good enough at Christmas.
I said about 17 teams. One of them was about to be right.
Last night, Manchester City won at Newcastle. Raheem Sterling, his 13th goal in the Premier League, his best ever scoring season. Lovely pass from Kevin De Bruyne.
That was a very weird game.
Gary Neville in the commentary was saying, this is embarrassing for the first half hour. Carragher afterwards said, you know, the Premier League is becoming a bit of a joke. And I bow down to their greater knowledge and probably their greater broadcasting ability, but I just didn't agree at all. I thought it's exactly what Newcastle United should do. Yes, you're going to concede chances if you've got 10 men behind the ball, if you've got 4 men behind the ball, whatever. But actually, if you can somehow stay in the game, then you can stay in the game and you might have a chance. Dwight Gayle went down. A penalty could have been given. It wasn't, but it could have been given, or he could have stayed on his feet and shot. And I kind of thought the Newcastle fans accepted this and actually got behind this kind of football, which was cheering whenever the ball wasn't a goal. Whenever it went out of play for any reason but wasn't a goal, they were happy.
I thought it was a really strange game. And, you know, we've seen, obviously, teams are doing this to Manchester City now a lot. The last game I saw where Manchester City played away was Huddersfield, who did a similar thing, but just more successfully. Newcastle never stopped the flow of chances for all the men they had behind the ball, and it just was weird. Their total lack of ambition. There's one moment when Yedlin was played into space on the right wing, and he ran onto the ball about the halfway line. His first touch was bad, gave it back to a Manchester City player, and I was doing the minute by minute, and I mentioned that they'd just had a touch in the Manchester City half. And a moment later, Newcastle's Twitter feed said Yedlin launches raid on down flank, but defence snuffs out the danger. And it was weird.
Was it an embarrassment, though? I mean, what's Carragher's quotes as well, saying, it's becoming an embarrassment in the Premier League. It's a joke. The teams at the top are so far ahead. The teams at the bottom are accepting they're going to lose the game. And long as it's by one or two, they're not going to give it a go. It's not just Rafa and Newcastle. There has to be some aggression and then some sort of plans to go forward. But at home, it's a sad state of affairs.
Well, it almost worked out for Newcastle. They should have been more than one goal behind at half time. City should have been out of sight, but they weren't. And when Newcastle did attack, that was the so Vincent Kompany got his traditional injury. Manchester City thought they're not going to attack us, so we don't really need defenders, and brought on another striker. And then on the very rare occasions when Newcastle did attack, they looked in real trouble. Otamendi had a good game. Both the statistic was that he hit more successful passes than the entire Newcastle team, including substitutes.
Apart from the goalkeeper. Outfielders only.
Yeah. Oh, right. Outfielders only.
122 to 115, if you include Elliot. I think it was 131 for Newcastle.
And he performed a brilliant goal line headed clearance. Mm. But they were seriously fallible to Newcastle. And Newcastle could have got something. So in the end, all the whinging and mockery in the first half was made to look ridiculous by the last 15, 20 minutes when City were rocking a bit. But at the time, it did look genuinely silly.
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple of things going on there. You know, one is that I think the experience of Guardiola's Barcelona, people are now less scared of the notion of a team having 80% possession. I mean, I think it was 78 in the end yesterday, but there was a moment with about 20 minutes to go when it looked like City might break the record, Premier League record, for most possession in a game.
It was 83% in the first half.
Yeah, 82.3% or 82.28% is the record, which was City against QPR when they won the title in 2012. So I was sitting there thinking, oh yeah, this is one of your moments of dandling your grandchild on your knee. I was there at the most soporific game I've ever been to, where the home fans, 50,000 home fans, were cheering every time Hossley miscontrolled the ball near the halfway line. So I think that idea of you know, when Barcelona first came along, we were sort of teams sort of panicked because they hadn't seen the ball for 2 or 3 minutes. Now I think teams are sort of, well, it's all right, we don't need it. We can play like this, we can get something out of a game like this. So I think there's been sort of a paradigm shift there that whereas maybe the embarrassment factor kicked in at 70-30, now it kicks in at 80-20. You know, that's changed. But I also think, you know, there's been a lot of talk, and I know Jan-Olga Fjortoff was talking about this, that comparing City's domination to Bayern's and saying, you know, all you people who criticise the Bundesliga, this is just what happens. But I think there is a difference. And the difference is that City are this far ahead because they're a really good side, not just because they're really wealthy. Now, Bayern were a really good side and also had revenues 50% higher than Dortmund, who are the second best team in the second highest in the Bundesliga. Whereas City are, you know, spent a huge amount, as Jose Mourinho reminds us. The revenues are still less than Manchester United's. There's still another four teams in the Premier League in the world's top 12 by revenue. So it's not one team streets ahead. It's one team with significant advantages who are streets ahead because they're a really good side. So I think there's a difference between just having a really good team and being a really rich team.
Speaking of Manchester United, £300 million I've spent is not enough, says Jose. We're in the second year of rebuilding a team that we know is not the best in the world. Man City buy fullbacks for the price of strikers. Cue lots of people showing pictures of Luke Shaw, who was more expensive than... who was he more expensive than? Gabriel Jesus, I think.
That's right, yeah. Well, and also, who's the most expensive midfielder in Manchester?
Paul Pogba.
Yeah, so just because you spent your money...
And the most expensive centre forward?
Yeah, Romelu Lukaku, yeah. Mm. So just because you spent your money on an unfashionable position doesn't somehow make it, you know, more obscene. It's...
Correct. So what did we make of that game against Burnley? I mean, I've done two radio shows the last couple of days, and whenever you mention Manchester United, lots of Burnley fans say, come on, it's about time you gave Burnley some credit. Their away record against the top team in this division is astonishing, really.
It is astonishing, sorry. As was the free kick goal, mm-hmm. Defoe's free kick goal, which is just gorgeous. And they're a lot of fun. It's really hard to logically explain, particularly in the context of last season and their troubles away from home. But phenomenal to watch. It was and ended up being a really exciting game.
And they were without Tarkowski as well, suspended Ward, Brady, Chris Wood as well.
Yeah, so what I was just about to say that they had a load of injuries. I think Burnley this season have been playing some really good football. I still think their goal that they scored away at Everton when they won 1-0, I think Jeff Hendrick got it, was still one of the best goals I've seen all season. I think it was a 24 move pass. So it's not just kind of sit back and hit teams on the counter. I mean, the early spells against United Old Trafford, they dominated the ball and deservedly went 2-0 up and just couldn't quite hold out. But to go back to Mourinho, I mean, on one level, I have a little bit of sympathy with him, just on the fact that you can spend as much money as you want, but it's difficult to catch City at the moment. I think he's probably finding himself in the same position he did at Real Madrid, where you're just coming up against this force, which just seem, you know, as well as you do, you always seem completely inferior to them. And obviously, that force being City and Barcelona in the Real Madrid case. But the sort of counter arguments, I mean, one is obviously what we've just said, the money that Man United have spent is extraordinary. Also, they're only 4 points better off this season than they were last year, which given they've spent at the same stage after 20 games, so given they spent £150 million in this summer alone, they should surely be doing better. They should at least be closer to City. And also, which players has Mourinho improved since he took over that he's inherited? I mean, I put this out on Twitter before I came up here because I was curious, because I don't watch as much as Manchester United as a lot of people. And the names I got back were Marcus Rojo, Phil Jones, Jesse Lingard, Marouane Fellaini, Antonio Valencia possibly. I mean, he could do what Guardiola's doing and actually coach the players he's got, make them better, as opposed to continuously moaning about the lack of money he's got. And just a final rant on Mourinho. It's clear that he reads the press, in particular the stuff that's said about him. He references it in press conferences a lot, things that have been written about him. He must know then that he's being perceived or he's being written about as a man who moans all the time and looks for excuses. So I don't understand why he keeps trotting them out, particularly after a draw at home to Burnley. I mean, if he'd come out after the Burnley game and just said, look, hands up, that's poor, we should be beating Burnley at home, I think he actually would have got quite a lot of credit. People's gone, fair enough. But then he comes out with obviously this rubbish about how much money he needs to make them better.
The only explanation I broadly agree with you. The only explanation I can come up with for that is that there's been quite a lot, you know, Philippe was mentioning it here a couple of weeks ago. And there's been various pieces in The Guardian, you know, various other people have talked about it, that suddenly people are talking about where City's money's come from. So it does sort of, if you want to undermine City, if you want to sort of tarnish what they're doing, focusing on the money and its origin does make some kind of sense. That's the only thing I think he was doing, was sort of pointing at that again.
He has a long-standing habit of coming out with some diversionary randomness after disappointing results. So there he was doing it again.
But on that as well, is it's kind of like a tree falls in the woods situation, Mourinho. Now, if we all say he's trying to do that to divert attention away from the result, then is he actually diverting attention away from the result? Because we're all aware he's doing it. Now, every time he does one of these things, we all say, oh, look, he's trying to divert attention away from the result. So therefore, it's failing because we're all absolutely clued up to what he's doing.
The strange thing is that you could have spun that result quite easily as, you know, we got caught a bit cold, we let in two goals in the first half, but we did come back, we did get a point.
Absolutely.
This could have been a lot worse.
Mm-hmm. I think he did say at some point he gave credit to his players for doing that.
But that's not the headline. That's not the headline. Up. And Mourinho's somebody who, part of his whole shtick is his ability to manipulate the press and manipulate headlines.
You say he reads the press. Do you reckon he listens to this? Like if we all went on about him being a silly sausage, that he might come out his next press conference and say, you all think I'm a silly sausage.
Well, let's see.
He's a silly sausage. And that'll do for part one. In part two, we'll start with a routine win for Chelsea and we'll talk about the controversy at the Vitality. Welcome back to part two of Guardian Football Weekly Extra, Christmas-ish edition. Bournemouth 3, West Ham 3. Only one place to start with this, Simon, was Callum Wilson's touch of magic. And I've just come off the radio, right, this morning. And because we weren't talking about it, West Ham fans were saying, if this was a bigger game, you'd have been talking about it, this cheating conspiracy that's got us. Callum Wilson should be banned for deceiving the referee and bringing football into disrepute. And while I don't think there's an agenda against West Ham, they have a real right to be really angry about what happened in the last minute of that game.
They were going to get 3 points until an offside player handballed the ball into the net. I guess a bit like Burnley Arsenal last year, a massive last minute result changing offside handball goal. So they're not unique in their misery. And I don't know, as a neutral, it was all a bit of a laugh, wasn't it? it was a bit of fun. I disapprove of cheating in almost every circumstance. I thought Callum Wilson, you know, most players when they handball the ball in, they're like, yeah, it hit my chest, and they're like pointing at their chest or at their head. I thought his "it didn't hit me at all" argument was a novel twist on the genre, so I appreciated that.
Well, you presumably seen the flag.
So he is deceiving the officials. I mean, West Ham fans are saying Lanzini got done for two games for going down easily in a challenge at Stoke. He was banned for two games. West Ham have lost those two games. Callum Wilson, because in the interview he came out, he agreed to be interviewed, and then he said, oh, it was a touch of magic, basically saying, I touched it and I didn't tell Bobby Manley I touched it. He's deceiving everybody.
Yes, he is. I mean, I suspect the handball itself was probably accidental, but in fact, his hands up, he is still handball. The offside, I mean, if the offside just hadn't been given, I don't think anybody would have been that upset. It was so tight that you're talking about is a foot ahead of a leg. You know, but the point is the offside was given. So, you know, it is then offside until Bobby Madley decides, oh, he hasn't touched it. So, I think he's probably interfering anyway, whether he's touched it or not. If you're coming in at the back post, the keeper's got to take you into account.
I don't think it was going in. It looked like it was just
going
wide.
Maybe, I don't know. Yeah,
so
yeah.
Therefore, it really is interfering.
He punched ball in the net. That is interfering. Even if he hadn't touched it, I think he was interfering.
It is a compelling argument that he deceived the match officials in order to get an advantage in a decisive situation, and that there is equivalence with diving to win a penalty. So I think that's a very compelling argument, fun as it was at the time.
Simon, did you also find Asmir Begovic's slip fun? Well, while you were having fun watching this,
Begovic had a bit of a bad game. He was responsible for a couple of West Ham's goals. Had a bit of a stinker, which was I've got no particular fondness for Bournemouth or for Begovic, but the final result cheered me up a bit because I was feeling a bit sad for him.
Yeah.
It's a sentimental time of year.
Actually, I interviewed him years ago in Bosnia, and he was very helpful and friendly. And then he lost the key card for his hotel, and I found it and gave it back. And he was very grateful in a way.
He's a bright guy. He sent a tweet going, crazy game yesterday. Very well-deserved point for us in the end. We go again on Saturday. # Premier League. # keep grinding. # slip in heck. And then some cherries and a football. So there we go. Chelsea beat Brighton 2-0. Sachin, sort of regulation for Chelsea, really. I mean, there's a beauty to the way Aspilicueta delivers a ball, and not very wide position either, is an incredible skill, and teams should probably be wise to it.
Yeah, and specifically to Alvaro Morata as well, which is, I mean, they've got an incredible relationship. I think there is a stat about there that's the most prolific combination in the Premier League this
five
season.
Five times now, isn't it?
Five times, yeah. It was against Spurs and...
And four of them are that kind of ball for the header, and one was just a ball over top and they went on to.
Yeah, he's a great survivor, isn't he, Azpilicueta? I mean, I know Chelsea churn managers quite a lot anyway, but he's played under quite a few as well, isn't he?
He's always just solid, isn't he? He doesn't make a mistake.
Really
he's,
good player. Yeah.
And he can play. Stick him at centre-back, he's fine. Play him at right-back, he's good.
Yeah.
You know, he's just such a useful player to have in your team.
Phenomenal. I mean, he must have cost very little as well when they signed him, so he's done really well. But I mean, Chelsea are interesting. I mean, they're really on United's coattails now. They're 1 point behind them. And again, Man City have completely skewered the league this year because Chelsea are actually doing pretty well. I mean, 13 wins, 42 points. I don't know how that compares to where they were last year. Probably not as much as I had, obviously, at this stage last year because they went on to win the league. But they are actually having quite a good season. But there's that sort of sense of crisis there. Maybe crisis is a bit strong, I don't know. But yeah, a routine win and they look pretty good, I think, Chelsea.
Brighton have been linked with Moussa Dembélé from Celtic.
Yeah,
is it 15 million? It said like a fee had been agreed, but I don't know if it has, and I don't know if he's going yet.
This would be the strangest transfer since Juninho went to Middlesbrough. I'm going to throw that out there. That's probably a bit strong, but just he was like being linked with like really big teams, wasn't he? And he's a really good player from what I can tell. Now he's going to possibly go to Brighton.
Could get more money from him as well.
It's really weird. I just can't get my head around it.
Producer Mel says Sky Sources announced it, and then it disappeared from Sky Sources. Hey, Watford beat Leicester 2-1, Simon. Did you go? Did you have a nice time? Didn't you go? How'd you feel?
I was forced to be in the office on the 26th, so I was unable to go.
Did you throw a strop with head of sport at The Guardian?
So I'm going to be away in the Lake District over New Year, and you have to work either Boxing Day or New Year's Day. There's a lot of sport, and you can't be loafing about for both of them. So I had to take it on the chin. But it was... Watford had been pretty low. Watford's last two performances against Huddersfield, which was, you know, a tragicomedy, and Brighton, where Watford just were very, I don't know, lethargic, confused. It was a very different performance. Doucouré was back. He's a fabulous player, and... continues to do fabulous things, but it was, you know, energetic and they... what was also impressive was that they fell behind. Leicester had missed a couple of chances, scored a goal, and a team in a very poor run of form turned the game around from there.
Are you worried that Doucouré might go in January? Or would you, if you were an independent advisor, would you recommend a bigger club to come in for him?
So Talk this morning in the Mirror, whose reporter Mike Walters is very well connected at Watford, is that he's going to be given a bumper new contract, the biggest in Watford's history. I think he is a phenomenal defensive midfielder, and I think that he would improve the vast majority of teams in the Premier League.
So, I mean, even because Sachin was talking about, say, Liverpool earlier in the pod.
Yeah.
He's that good?
Yeah. Yeah, Liverpool, Arsenal. I think he's a couple of levels above this Watford team.
Leicester now without a win in four in all competitions. Huddersfield 1, Stoke 1. Jonathan, do you have anything to say about this game?
I found the kits quite hard to make out. I normally hate teams wearing their away kit. I think they wear them far too often. But there was a strange instance on Boxing Day of both that game...
And West Brom Everton,
yeah. West Brom Everton was even worse because the back of West Brom's kit doesn't even have stripes. So it was just too...
I mean, it was even worse as well as a game, wasn't it?
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Sachin, anything to add to that? I mean, there were two penalty shouts on Aaron Moy and...
was it Juve for the Stoke penalty?
Was it Juve?
Yeah.
I was watching the highlights. So
yeah, when he's brought down by Christopher Schindler. Yeah, that was definitely a penalty. I mean, I still think there's sort of sense of death around Stoke. I still think Hughes won't see through the rest of the season, but he just seems to get these results that keep him in the job a little bit longer.
They've got Newcastle next, haven't they? Or maybe is that New Year's Day, maybe?
Yeah.
So... that, I think, is quite a big game.
Yeah, certainly for both teams. Yeah.
You mentioned West Brom Everton. Everton have agreed a fee of £25 million with Beşiktaş for Cenk Tosun. And we should have texted Ryan Babel, really, to find out how he feels about it.
He's very good.
Tell us all about him, Jonathan.
When I interviewed Babel, I watched quite a bit of Beşiktaş. And he's one of those players I sort of couldn't quite believe he was... I think he's 26?
Yeah.
Couldn't quite believe that he was still in Turkey age 26 because he looks like he's got everything. You know, he's big, he's good in the air, he's mobile, he scores goals. I think he's a really good signing, and Everton are desperately lacking that type of player. I remember, it's a shame for Beşiktaş, and I'm sorry for them because I think it'll ruin the Champions League because that front three worked really well with him as sort of this very mobile centre-forward who would drop off. Ricardo Quaresma playing on the right, always going outside, getting crosses in, and Toshman's very good at attacking them. And then Babel coming in on the back post, you know, always cutting in off the left. And that three together worked really well. So it obviously is going to harm Beşiktaş's chances in the Champions League, but I think he's a very good signing for Everton. I'm kind of quite... I mean, excited too strong because it's only football, but I'm quite interested to see how he does at Everton.
Tonight, Arsenal go to Crystal Palace. This is Arsene Wenger's 810th Premier League game, equaling Sir Alex Ferguson as a Premier League manager. Why are you laughing?
Well, it's just another number, isn't it? pluck a period out and say, you know, it's the most in this arbitrary period or non-arbitrary period. Right, period. The period's the important thing.
Okay.
It's a number.
Do you think he's halfway yet to his career?
we'll see. I think it could be around forever.
Yeah, I mean, I think people will look back on the first 21 years. So they were up and down, weren't they?
I was going to give him some credit there. It's pretty extraordinary, even if it's an arbitrary period of time.
Yeah, I'm going to be hypocritical about the whole arbitrary thing because I think this is quite a nice arbitrary figure. I just think purely because Wenger's only managed in the Premier League era, so he can't be judged against anything else. And I think to match up with Ferguson, who is, you know, let's face it, the sort of the godfather of the Premier League era, is pretty significant. He'll obviously go past him as well, unless he's sacked after the Palace game, which would be pretty extraordinary.
But is that just Ferguson's games in the Premier League?
Premier League games, yeah.
Yeah, so Ferguson's got another 6 years on him.
Yeah, well, Ferguson's obviously first Premier League game was in 92, and then he left in 2013.
Yeah, so it's another 6 years of Ferguson to add on. So it is arbitrary.
So you're right, Simon. It is totally arbitrary.
Yeah.
Arsene basically needs to raise it and hang around for another 6 years until he can equal.
Oh, he will. Don't worry about that.
Do you think he will? I mean, genuinely, how far do you reckon he's got? How long
Arsene Wenger's many problems. Longevity is not one of them.
No.
I think he's like the Dalai Lama. I think that shortly before death, he'll give some sort of hint of look and sort of indicate where he may be reborn 7 weeks later. And then he'll take some items of clothing, lay them out on a tray, so all the Chips Keswick will be there with all these babies who are born on the right date. And whichever baby crawls to the Wenger zip coat first will be the new manager of Arsenal.
The Dalai Lama was a guest judge on Australian MasterChef once, which was great because he ate all the food and then they said, which was your favourite? And he said, as the Dalai Lama, I'm not here to judge. In most places, the Dalai Lama are a good position. Not really as a judge on a reality TV show.
I met him in 1994.
Did you?
Lovely man, yeah.
How was he? What did you discuss?
We discussed the Tibetan situation. We discussed refugee monks in Dharamsala, which is where I was, because I was teaching them, which is why I met him. And he talked a little bit about horse racing. Massive into the horses. He's not. Massive.
just on Wenger, if I can bring your mate Paul Merson into this.
Yeah. Max,
he said something a little, I think it was last season on some programme, which really stuck with me, which I'm sure has been said a million times before, but it just, when we talk about Wenger and longevity, he said that the thing with Arsene Wenger is he just hasn't got any interests outside of football. Whereas Ferguson had his horses and golf and probably a few other things. Wenger's just got nothing, and so he's utterly scared to retire, basically, because he won't have anything else to fill his time. And I think that's quite sad, really. I mean, if that is true, and he has no interest outside of football, and he's basically just sticking around because he can't think what he'll do on his Saturday afternoons, I think that's quite a sad state of affairs.
Really. You're right about Sir Alex, because he would always be at Punchestown with the Dalai Lama.
Exactly.
Watching the 145. Fitbar. No Barry, so I'll attempt Fitbar Corner. Celtic moved 11 points clear at the top with victory over Dundee at Dens Park. I did go with a Scottish friend, David, to watch the City Newcastle game on one telly and the Hearts Hibs game on another telly. But the feed to the Hearts Hibs game was so stop start that it was basically like a still.
I think that's just Scottish football, isn't it?
Every 2 minutes, the screen changed and someone was taking a throw in. So you actually had, I literally no idea. It was like watching an Amstrad computer game.
It was live
game.
On Sky though, wasn't it? Was this in a pub?
Yeah.
So why was the feed? Because it wasn't like it was some dodgy.
No. The feed for the City Newcastle game was absolutely perfect. And had the commentary, whereas my Scottish mate David, big Hearts fan, was just increasingly incensed because he could almost watch it but couldn't. It was a bit like in the World Cup in 2010. I was in Belize on an island watching the USA England, and we go 1-0 up, and that's great. And lots of Americans there, and I'm really happy. And then Clint Dempsey. There's a sort of tropical storm, and Clint Dempsey does that pee roller, and then the screen just freezes for about 3 minutes. And it comes back and it's 1-1. And literally none of us had... There was just no... We just couldn't conceive of how the USA could have scored a goal. It just wasn't possible. Anyway, back to Fitbar.
Maybe they just redacted the football that they didn't consider suitable for a family audience.
That's what Polish TV did in 1982, when there's lots of pro-solidarity protests at the World Cup. So The World Cup feed in Poland was on a delay of, I don't know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And they just blacked out any banner in the crowd that mentioned Solidarność.
Oh, really? Celtic, they were 11 points clear. They're now 8 points clear because of Aberdeen's win. And in the Edinburgh derby, Oliver Shaw was denied a goal for Hibs that appeared to cross the line but wasn't given. No goal line technology in Scotland. Celtic play Rangers Saturday lunchtime. That'll do for part two. In part three, we'll do the Football League feedback corner, any questions, and then we'll all go home. Welcome back to part three. Before we do the Football League, Simon, you want to pick up on my... I said a bit more Fitbar extra corner. I said it appeared to cross the line.
Well, it didn't so much appear to cross the line. It did cross the line. It certainly appeared to cross the line in the photograph of it having crossed the line that appeared on my Twitter feed.
Which is why Sachin Neil Lennon was incandescent with rage.
Yeah, I've seen clips of Neil Lennon raging, but I wasn't sure why, but that obviously explains it. Mm.
I will draw your attention to the 2014 Neil Lennon calendar. Please Google it. It's one of the greatest things in the history of football.
It's not actually
kind of like Brian Laws jumping over a canal. I'm sure there's evidence of this. And I mentioned it every week when it first came out. And I'd never met Neil Lennon. And then I met him about a year ago. So this is, 2 or 3 years after the calendar. And he shouted across a golf course, "Don't mention the calendar again!" So, sorry, Neil. Tony Pulis is the new Middlesbrough manager. Simon, how will the fans of Middlesbrough take this news?
Well, I think Tony Pulis has become, well, of all successful managers, of all managers with a very long history of managerial achievement, he is the most depressing one for your team to appoint. Obviously.
I didn't see it going that way, too. That's brilliant. It's a real U-turn on there.
he has developed a reputation as a kind of specialist, an avoid relegation from the Premier League specialist. And so this was a casting against type, I suppose, and that's what brings it some interest. But and the football will gradually lose interest, although in Middlesbrough's case that may be hard to achieve.
Well, his press conferences are... I mean,
I really like him. That's I was amazed that West Brom didn't sack him 2 years ago. I thought, like, they appointed him, he saved them in his first kind of part season. In his first full season, he kind of reinforced that. And at that point, you get rid of Pulis and you seek a different answer to a different question. And they didn't do that. They waited ages too long. And the football West Brom were playing got gradually more dreary. And so I was happy to see the back of him at West Brom. But every time I went to see West Brom as a journalist, he's a lovely guy. He comes into the press conference and totally disarms my negativity.
I was up at Newcastle last night. And so a lot of the journalists there had been at the Pulis unveiling the day before. So what do you think the most common question that was asked to people who'd been at that unveiling was?
Did he stand up?
Was he wearing
it wasn't much whether was he stood up.
Brand new hat and trainers?
No, it was very much about standing up. And what did the Middlesbrough press officer do? Apparently the Middlesbrough press officer sort of discussed it with him. Lads, what do you think I should do? And then eventually Pulis came and I'm just going to sit. Like, this is ridiculous. I can't stand up for this long.
Oh, did he sit down?
The press officer did. Pulis stood.
The press officer. Yeah. I just think it's a really depressing appointment to get to sort of follow on from what Simon said. I mean, Middlesbrough are ninth in the Championship, if I'm not mistaken. I haven't got a table to hand. They're only a few points off the playoffs. They've got one of the biggest budgets in the Championship. And they go hire a manager whose football is safety first and who's renowned for not getting relegated. I don't see the point of it.
I would love him at Sunderland.
Yeah, well, that's they're a very special case, aren't they? Let's face it.
There was someone on the radio, and I forget who it is, which is annoying, but they were talking about Pulis, I think, just around the time he was leaving West Brom, and he said, the one thing about Tony Pulis is he likes to leave clubs on good terms. And then you remember back to Crystal Palace and Steve Parish and buying land and needing money. And thinking, I'm not sure he always does. Elsewhere, Wolves were held to a 2-2 draw at Millwall, still increased their lead to the top to 8 points because second place Cardiff were beaten 4-2 at home by Fulham, their first home Championship defeat of the season. Bristol City are now level on points with Cardiff. They beat Reading 2-0. And Derby are fourth. They drew 0-0 with Hull. Did anyone see this Burton and Leeds game where Stephen Bywater, the Burton goalkeeper, was booked for pulling Unai Kane's shorts down before a free kick was taken? Which
you can see a full clip of this free kick. It's a really fascinating watch because it goes on for about 3 or 4 minutes and it involves Bywater pulling down someone's shorts. But the routine, Leeds' set-piece routine, is really interesting. They put two men right in front of Bywater and that's why he actually pulls the shorts down, because he's got his two guys right in front of him and then they split. It's basically almost three walls. And it's like the third wall, which creates this kind of shield that Bywater can't see through. And they split at just at the right moment, or move just at the right moment, and the ball goes past the goalkeeper. It's really worth it. It's quite an interesting, novel free kick routine.
Is it breaking the fourth wall that you should never do? So at least they didn't do that.
There was the actual wall, the Burton wall. Then there were two Leeds players in front of that wall or just behind that wall. And then there were these other two players in front of Bywater. So I think that's, what, three walls, isn't it? Yeah.
And is pulling someone's shorts down, is there an official law about that? Or is it ungentlemanly conduct?
It certainly sounds like an ungentlemanly conduct. Although there's certain kit that a player has to be wearing, otherwise they themselves are cautioned. So perhaps they should both have been booked. Because if you're not wearing shorts, that's not.
But you get booked for taking your shirt off, don't you? One player, I'm sure, pulled his shorts down when he scored a goal. I forget who it was. Anyway, all very playground and therefore quite funny. Sheffield United got their first win in 7. They beat Sunderland, Jonathan, 3-0. Here's Chris Coleman's quotes. It's a bitterly disappointing performance. And as soon as we went 1-0 down, we just accepted a low-level performance from each other. It's the first time I've seen that from them. When you're in that position, it's not anger, it's apathy.
It's not the first time I've seen that from them.
which is very, very dangerous. So are you preparing for League One?
I really wasn't until Saturday. And Saturday was so bad that, I don't know, maybe.
Another team not doing so well, Aston Villa, who were, you know, in the playoff spots and doing all right. Winless in five. They lost at Brentford, they're now down to eighth in League One. News today, Charlton CEO Katrine Meyer is to step down at the end of the month after 4 years in the role. Eight permanent managers have been in place during her time there. In the club's statement, the owner, Roland de Châtelet, which is very good to say in a Jim White voice, Roland de Châtelet, says no replacement being sought as they're currently in talks with various interested parties regarding a potential takeover. They're ninth in League One, two points off the playoff places. Wigan and Shrewsbury, the top two, played out a 0-0 draw. Wigan 4 points clear, and Blackburn, three successive wins at home with a 2-0 win over Rochdale. In League Two, Luton's goal-scoring exploits continue. They thrashed Swindon 5-0, 58 for the season so far. 4 points above Notts County in second. Cambridge beat Barnet 1-0. Jonathan, George Weah is the president of Liberia.
I thought the final vote was today. I thought the final count was today.
I thought he'd got in this morning.
Maybe. I mean, I've been on a train all day, so maybe that count is finished.
I just presumed, with your incredible knowledge, you just know everything about George Weah.
How is it George Weah's final ever international?
Okay.
Which was at the Cup of Nations of 2002 in Mali, and it was against Nigeria in Mopti, which I think is now under Islamist control and you can't get there. But it's where you used to get the ferry from to go to Timbuktu. It's an extraordinary place. It's the football stadium is in the middle of a lake. So it's built on this lagoon. And as you go into the town, there's this huge billboard, this peeling billboard that says, "Welcome to Mopti, the Venice of Africa." Much like when I went to Venice and found this sign saying, "Welcome to Venice, the Mopti of northeast Italy."
Oh, I do like... I was at Finsbury Park Station once, waiting for a tube, and there was a big poster that with pictures of a sort of a town I couldn't quite recognise, and it said, "Doncaster, a city in all but name." And you thought... That's what you've come up with. And who getting on the Piccadilly line is thinking, where do I want my mini break to be?
The next night in the Hotel L'Amitié in Bamako, which was pretty much the only good hotel in Bamako. I think eight of the teams were staying there. It was this big party for George Weah, so, you know, his big farewell of international football, and an extraordinary night that. Journalists, fans, players, all mixing in this bar. So Shibani Nonda was playing drums, Tariba West was singing. Wow. And then I won't tell you who the journalist in question was, but we spill out the bar in the early hours, and the sort of the barn, there's a terrace, and then there's a swimming pool, sort of, I don't know, 30, 40 feet below.
Oh, no.
So you went round this sort of this path through the forest. And as we're going down this path, you know, the lights are going on, and suddenly there's this sort of awkward shuffling sound, and we see the, you know, lit up in the moonlight, the retreating buttocks of a prominent British football journalist who had been having fun with a local lady on one of the sun lounges.
Can we guess?
Not on air. I'll tell you afterwards.
Oh, okay, fine.
He's not working today, shall we say. He is retired.
Okay. So the provisional result, he's set to be announced as the president of Liberia. It's a fascinating story because he ran in 2005, and amongst the sort of intellectual elite, it was seen that he just didn't have an education. So what are you doing, George? So then he went back to school. Then he got a degree in business in the States and has come back to take control of his country. If we were to have a prime minister who was a former England international, who would you go for?
Peter Crouch. I think life under Crouch would be wonderful.
Is he a former England international?
Has he officially retired?
I still harbour hopes.
Martin Keown.
That'd be awful. It'd be anarchy.
I think there's more likely to be anarchy with Crouch than there would with Keown. Yeah, Keown would be disciplined,
and
wouldn't
he? And what Keown would be good at would be those sort of very sort of sombre speeches after, you know, on Remembrance Day or something.
The
ashen face as he remembers the fallen.
I think Barney Rone once said he looks like a sad policeman, which was a really...
But he also said that he delivers the most banal analysis in the manner of a of a man reading the oration at his family sort of pet rabbit who's just died.
Anyway, Simon, do you have any England internationals you'd like to be the Prime Minister?
No, not really. I'd take Tony Pulis.
Okay.
One, it would get him out of management, which would be his first gift to the nation.
He's Welsh, we should probably point out at this stage before the emails come flooding.
So he can still be Prime Minister.
Yeah, I'm just saying he's not in former England.
No, what you're saying is you don't want a Welsh Prime Minister,
I'm
which
not
is even
that right.
More important.
No, absolutely not.
Have we had one since Lloyd George?
Very good question.
Almost it'll probably iconic, be almost iconic, didn't we, in 92?
Probably be Ellis James. He's good at everything. incredible story from Ecuador. I don't know if anyone's seen this.
Yes.
El Nacional had a 53-year-old record of only fielding Ecuadorian players, Jonathan.
And they got cheated by some player who turned out to be Colombian, but they forged his passport.
Yeah, Rinson Lopez joined in 2016. He's actually Colombian and admitted he'd falsified documents when he moved there when he was 17. We mentioned Emmanuel Mbue on Monday. Galatasaray have come in to employ him as an assistant coach for their under-14s, provided him with a salary and found him accommodation. So well done to you. Did we want to do best and worst moments of 2017? Did you any of you prepare this?
Can do.
Okay, well, Jonathan, you can, and you can join in if you...
Well, I mean, both come in the Cup of Nations in at the beginning of the year, and the best moment was probably Vincent Aboubakar's winner for Cameroon, 10 minutes ago, something like that. A really nice goal, flicked the ball over an Egyptian defender and lashed it in. And anything that avoids extra time is always a good thing when you're trying to write on the game. And the worst moment also there, which I don't know, I mean, is it a football thing or not? I guess even the fact the tournament was going ahead in a country that really couldn't afford it, shouldn't have been trying to afford it. And when we, I'm sure I've told this story before, so I won't go into too much detail, but I was going to a press conference from the held by the opposition leader Jean Ping, and the taxi driver dropped me rather than at Ping's residence at the campaign headquarters from the election last year, and went in and suddenly realised something really horrendous had happened there, that there was bullet holes everywhere and blood on the walls, and researched it with Nick Ames and Tamor Lay, and we proved 29 people were massacred. So you're trying to cover the football and at the same time report on that. So, you know, the political backdrop to football is always there. But if you want something on the pitch, then any single Sonic performance this year has been pretty awful.
Sachin?
Yeah, I've got a best, which was the Clásico in April, Real Madrid 2, Barcelona 3. Genuinely one of the best football matches I've ever seen. It was the game which ended with Messi getting that, I think, 92nd-minute winner, and then when he held his shirt up to the Real Madrid fans, it was just a great game for the drama, back and forth. I think James Rodriguez made it 2-2 at 85 minutes. Ramos got sent off, as he always gets sent off, and you think that's it, and then Messi scores this lovely first-time finish goal on the back of a counter-attack. My worst moment, slightly personal base, but it was a statement which Liverpool put out on the 20th of December where they talked about formulating a long-term ticket pricing strategy, and it contained for me this heart-sinking line from club's managing director Billy Hogan, where he said at some point there has to be more revenue from ticketing. And as I said, it just makes my heart sing, because I just think in this era of huge global TV deals and massive commercial deals, the one thing you don't need to increase is ticket pricing, especially if you're a club like Liverpool who have huge income from those sources. And there is an issue with the atmosphere at Anfield and the fact younger fans can't get into the ground. I just think the one thing Liverpool can do is try and not increase ticket prices and try and get more younger fans into the ground. They've had issues with this with the infamous walkout at Anfield a couple of years ago when they were about to introduce £77 tickets, and it just feels like they just don't learn their lessons as a club. And they do a lot of good things, and I know they have introduced some reduced ticket prices to get younger fans in, but it just feels like a real misstep that I thought.
Simon, do you have a best and worst? And if you do, could you do worst and then best so we finish on a high?
Worst is probably the repeated Carabao Cup draw Fandangos.
That's the best, surely. It's brilliant.
Well, it might be the best. It could probably be both, because I don't really have a best. I did like it when earlier in the year, the Plymouth manager declared that he didn't want his team playing in their home kit anymore because it was green, and the players were confusing each other for grass, and it was all getting a bit messy. So I like that. So they played most of last year wearing their white away shorts and socks rather than their all green kit, which was just too much like pitch for any footballer to understand. And then started this season with a a luminous green home kit, which can no longer be confused for anything.
So
other
do you
than
think Plymouth have been disadvantaged by the absence of muddy pitches? That in the old days, their kit stood out against the green, stood out against brown.
Possibly the shade of they had a particularly dark shade of green last season, which obviously did them no favours. They got more points away from home than at home last season. Obviously, away they could wear a full white, very eye-catching.
Maybe
kit.
Artificial snow is the answer. Just cover home park in artificial snow and wear the home kit.
It could be. It could be. Keep. I mean, they're stuck with a green kit of some sort. So they need a different kind of pitch.
Has to be green in FA regulations, so Football League regulations. I
suspect you could dye the pitch.
Yeah. Well, at Augusta, they dye the water blue, don't they? Mm. So why not?
But Plymouth could change their kit. Didn't Palmer change their kit from white to yellow and blue in the mid late 90s? So
yeah,
Plymouth could just change
the other way, went from yellow and blue to white. Yeah. But no, I think we should stick with the green. I think. why change the shirts when you change the grass? Well, is Kentucky bluegrass actually blue?
That is not a question I know the answer to.
Seems you've got a tangent here.
It would have been really good if they'd changed the colour of the grass. I agree. If they'd have started playing in orange pitches. Once you announce your home kit to the Football League, you're kind of stuck with it for the remainder of the season. But I bet that there's nothing about painting your pitch green.
Although, the worst point for me, the low point of the season, was before the season started, the Leicester groundsman was told he was no longer allowed to cut those beautiful patterns into the pitch. They had to be kind of just straight lines. So presumably, if the FA are going to crack down on patterns on pitches, they may well use a similar law to crack down on the colour of the pitch.
I'd like to see a team trying to force them into a decision there.
Feedback corner. We'll finish on a high, so we'll do some of the other feedback first. Not a lot of it, don't worry, guys. Denim John says, question for you. Max, I've been listening to you since the Jimbo's put everyone in limbo scandal of the summer, and it occurs to me, are you actually getting more stupid as time goes by? No offence meant. I'm just genuinely curious. I put this out on Twitter. He's come back to say, actually, he was just joking, which is a shame because I'd much prefer if he really felt that. I mean, I've been degenerating since 1996. And Paul says, I think if I somehow acquired ownership of a racehorse, I'd now call it Sid Lowe's Garage Full of Ham. And that's a lovely way to finish today. Simon, thanks.
Pleasure.
Sachin, thanks.
Pleasure.
Jonathan, thanks.
Thanks. Happy New Year.
And to you. When are we back? Thursday. Thursday, the 4th of Jan. Hold your breath until then.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.